weather and Bad Bunny forecast a bad season for live music across the nation. Heavy rains, flooding, and extreme heat, mixed with ice raids and a total freeze on US tour dates by Bad Bunny and other superstar artists, might portend a perfect storm for the live music business during this all-important summer season of festivals and outdoor concerts. Remember Michael Stipe of REM? He had a lyric that went, "Should we talk about the weather? Should we talk about the government? Hi, 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 hi." Really weird song. Great weird song. And it resonates more today than when it dropped in 1989, at least when it comes to defining and divining where the music biz is at right now and where it's headed. I'm Bill Hochberg, and on this episode of the Music Law Beat, I'm joined by top music agent Jared Arfa, whose agency IAG handles Metallica, Billy Joel, Neil Young, Elvis Costello, Rod Stewart, 50 Cent, Neo, and I could go on and on. And we'll also have Danny Hayes, who has run some of the very best music festivals in America. And as an attorney, he's represented Linkin Park, Tool, and other fantastic talents. So we'll talk about the weather and cancellation insurance, and we'll talk about the government, including how Trump's immigration policies could collide with the live music biz, and also about the DOJ's antitrust case against Live Nation and Ticketmaster. I also write about this in a Forbes article that you can get in the materials. So get out your umbrella and get your protest sign, and let's get jamming. To just sort of start out with a little bit about your personal journey, kind of how did you get here? How did you get to what you're doing now? Danny, maybe start off, and I know you're an attorney, but you went from that to running one of the most respected festival companies, and you've done a lot of really cool things. Can you just give us a little bit of a background on you?
Yeah, so Bill, as I graduated law school in 1992 from USC, and started off working with a gentleman named Kim Guggenheim, and then eventually found my way to Manatt, Phelps and Phillips, where I practiced there for about 5 years, and then formed joined Fred Davis, and we formed Davis Shapiro at the time, Lewitt Montone and Hayes, with the great Ian Montone. And was there for about 10 years. And then along the way, I picked up a client, and his name was Danny Wimmer. And he was a record executive at Atlantic Records. He had signed Puddle of Mudd, Limp Bizkit, Staind, but he'd also started this little festival called Rock on the Range. And it quickly blew up into being one of the 20 largest festivals in the world, and became very apparent that he had a real business. So he decided to leave Atlantic Records, or at the time he was, I think he was actually at Epic. He left Epic Records to start Danny Wimmer Presents. And then about 18 months later, this is now July of 2014, convinced me to leave my law practice and become his partner in Danny Wimmer Presents. And that was my sudden and abrupt transition from lawyer to festival promoter.
Great. And you also mentioned Ian Montone. He was a lawyer, and then he for Jack White, and then he became Jack White's manager. Isn't that
Yeah,
right?
that
Yeah.
yeah, no, that's right.
The White Stripes. Okay, at
He got
the
out first. He was the first escapee.
time. Okay. Okay. And so Jared, talk to us a little bit
Sure.
about how you got into the business. I like to joke that I'm an attorney because I was born when I was born, they gave me a briefcase and then told me my office was over there. I come from a
Right.
family of lawyers. Not really. My parents were wonderful, but go ahead and tell me a little bit about your
Yes,
journey.
thanks for having me today, Bill. So, when I graduated college, I went to work for Bob Silliman, who at that time was running a company called CKX, which owned the rights to American Idol and Muhammad Ali's brand and Elvis Presley's brand. This had come on the tail end, and I'd actually had worked for Mitch Slater, who was Ron Delsner's partner in Delsner Slater, which was the big New York concert promotion company before the roll-up of all the concert promoters that Bob Silliman implemented and executed, which really is the foundation of what Live Nation is today. So Silliman is the one, and I think a lot of people, Danny knows this, but a lot of people who are newer to the music business don't know. But Bob Silliman is the one who had started SFX and bought all the independent promoters, which were like mafia fiefdoms, and rolled them all up. And then he ended up selling all of it to Clear Channel for like $4 billion or something like that. And it eventually got spun out to Live Nation and became Live Nation as we know it today. So I worked there for a handful of years, overseeing their brands. And then at a certain point, my father, who's been in the music business since, the early 70s, has been Billy Joel's agent for almost 50 years. He was running an independent agency. And I said to him, I'm doing a lot of M&A activity over here, and I think I can get you a check and we can go grow this business together. So at that point, I moved over and joined him at what was at the time Artist Group International. And a year later, we sold to Ron Burkle, who, supermarket magnate, used to own the Pittsburgh Penguins, owns the Soho houses, just very well-known, billionaire. And we did that for a while, and that's how Danny and I actually became, close, was because, Ron made an investment in Danny's business as well,
Through you.
through me. So I introduced them to Ron. And then, 2 years ago, we merged with APA and took over their music division. And Ron was the impetus for that as well, because he had made a minority investment in APA during the pandemic. So we're now intertwined in a much bigger, global agency that Ron is still a part owner of.
Fantastic. And your dad is Dennis Arfa, very well loved and respected in the business as well. And believe you also represent a lot of big name acts. But
Yes.
I think Metallica,
Oh,
Motley
yeah,
Crue.
our agent, we run the gamut from, Metallica and Billy and Rod Stewart and Motley Crue and Def Leppard to, younger artists, a lot of big rock bands like Ghost and Sleep Token, but also a lot in hip hop and R&B and 50 Cent and Mary J. Blige and Neo and Big X the Plug, who is on fire right now, probably, one of your favorites, Bill. But we have a big varied roster.
Great. And then, so when they gave me a briefcase when I was born, what did they give you? Maybe was it a phone or a fax machine? Maybe
I
that was
you
a
know I was definitely I, as I joked to someone, I said I knew I could probably name every song and everything in Billy Joel's catalog at like 3 years old. So, I grew up around
Were the Uncle Billy
Uncle
growing
Billy.
up?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few of them. It was really Billy, Rodney Dangerfield, Dice Clay, Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys. So there were, it's just that's kind of
Wow.
what I knew growing up, was going to these shows. And, even at 5 years old, like doing Dice Clay jokes, I didn't know what I was saying, but I knew it was
So
inappropriate.
both of you guys know live music backwards, forward, sideways, down, inside out. And so I'd love to hear what you guys talk about. Maybe we can start out with just giving us sort of a primer, if you will, on sort of festival and touring economics. Danny, do you want to jump in there and sort of lay it out for us?
Well, that is a super large
Sure.
topic you just laid out. So we might, if you want me to present the whole thing, it could be about an hour.
Just the basics of how it works. Yeah, I mean, we could do a 3-hour session here, but I think we'd get fired. I'd get fired here.
No,
I'd fire myself. Go ahead.
the thing that people are shocked about most about music festivals is just how expensive they have become. And just to give you some scale on that, when we first started producing Rock on the Range, the entire budget was maybe 6 million. Our kinds of festivals today are 30 million and more. And so much of that is topics I know we'll discuss today, which is inflation, artist inflation, the cost of everything under the sun going up. And so the risk reward profile of the festival business and the touring business for that matter has dramatically changed in the last 10 to 15 years. The profit margins have gone way down, and the risk has gone way up. But, and in the festival space, the largest expense is the talent. That can consume as much as 80 to 90% of a ticket price. So if I'm spending $100, so if a fan's spending $100 a ticket, that means $90 of that ticket is going to the artists that are playing that festival. And so, then where does my, and then the rest of the festival costs about 50% to produce. So you're like, well, then how are you making money? And it's all in all the other stuff. It's the beer. Festivals are kind of like the movie theater model now. You don't make money on the ticket sales. We're making money on the popcorn. And that's really how festivals have evolved in the last 10 or 15 years.
And isn't, I mean, Danny, that's obviously similar to the amphitheater model, right? And that's why for
And that's
many
where
years.
these agents, man, have done a great job turning the festival business into the amphitheater model. You're absolutely right, Jared.
Your work deserves more than attention, it deserves protection. Reigns is trusted by artists, producers, and creatives across the industry. With offices in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and beyond, we bring sharp legal thinking to litigation, business, real estate, and private client matters, protecting tomorrow and delivering today. We've got you. Reigns.
And I think, one point, as Danny brings up in the festival model, and then we, Bill, I don't want to stray too far from your question, but a lot of headliners, I mean, there's more arena and stadium headliners, I think, because of population growth and just so many different genres of music and niches that have, a handful of stars in each of them. So I think as we have more arena and stadium headliners, it's making it more challenging for festivals to be successful and really get those huge acts that are really the draw and the pull for these lineups. And I think, we're seeing more niche festivals, but you're not necessarily seeing, these huge ones that were the Bonnaroos and the Coachellas and the Lollapaloozas and the Austin City Limits popping up quite as much. And I think there's a dearth of headliners because a lot of them can now make as much money headlining arenas and stadiums, where the festival one-offs used to be an overpay. But because the economics have changed and they can maximize their revenue at these big shows where they control the production, it's their show, it's their audience, I think, it's made it also more challenging for the festivals to put
Yeah.
together great top-heavy lineups.
Let me just
Bill, I was going to say
point.
real quick for you, just give the audience context. When Jared said to me, hey, it's kind of like the amphitheater model, what he's referring to is a typical tour deal. When you go to see an artist playing an amphitheater, that artist is getting a guarantee against anywhere from 85 to 90, 95, or when they're a Jared Arfa client, 110% of the door. So that's what he's talking about is the artist is taking the vast majority of the ticket sales. The promoter is making a small amount on the
Right.
ticket, but most of the money's coming from the bar and the parking,
Right.
the
And when
thing.
you say guarantee, you're talking about a minimum guarantee, and
To the
it's
artist.
to the artist, and it can be overshot, so it can be higher than it should be, or it can be lower.
Well, I
But
don't
there's
know
an
that
art to that.
I would say should be is, I should, it all should go to the artist, but you can still make money on the in these other ancillary lanes that Danny mentions, as well as the ticketing fees, which, some of which goes to the, obviously to the venue, but some of which also goes to the promoter.
Well, let me point to a Goldman Sachs influential report that they put out every year, and it's called Music in the Air. It came out in June this month, and it is actually a little pessimistic on the overall global music business with its projection for the next 10 years, a little lower than it was, but still high. like it's going to double in 10 years, the revenue from that, the three sectors, which is recorded music, music publishing, and live music. And it's showing that the recorded part of it is down. Their projection for this year is down by about 2.5 billion from 33.9 billion to 31.4 billion. The publishing, which is publishing, is like sync licensing and it comes from streaming and all that for the song, is about the same at about 10.7 billion worldwide, according to their projection. Live revenue, though, is rosy. They're saying that live revenue forecast for this year, their expectation is it's up by about a half a billion from 37.7 billion to 38.2 billion. Why? Because they're saying that the average ticket price is rising 40% for stadiums and 37% for clubs between 2019 and 2024, last 5 years. And they're emphasizing that, quote, live music has, quote, proven to be more recession resilient than other forms of entertainment. So they're painting a rosy picture for the live sector. What's your reactions to that?
I think, we all realized during COVID that live music is, it's irreplaceable. There's nothing like that communal experience that you can get at a live event. And I think when people had that taken away, it was just a reminder of how necessary this was as a part of, life. And even if you're not a super fan, you still were used to going to a couple shows a year. And I just think that live is going to continue to rise. Where that correlates with ticket pricing, I do think for some of these superstar artists, like think about Taylor Swift's tour last year, where such an event where people were traveling around the world, daughters with their mothers traveling to other countries, it became such an event that you had to go to. It was almost like a badge of honor to be able to put that on your social media and say, I was there. That I think there's these big spectacles that artists are producing that I think there's, it's always existed to some degree, that I think become these like have to have moments and, culturally are so relevant that I think there's a premium for that. And I think it's not for everybody, but I think the superstar artists can command those type of premiums. And I also think that part of the reason why they're getting that premiums is also platinum and dynamic ticketing. So
Yeah, it was.
when you note it, when you say the rise, oh, 30 to 40%, there might have been a lot of that being made on the show. It just wasn't being made by the artists and the artist team. It was being made in the secondary market. And I think what Ticketmaster, although it always kind of gets beat up, has done a great job of doing is dynamic pricing like the airlines use, and platinum, which is, premium pricing for better tickets and better locations. They've done a great job at capturing that, which I think is another big piece of why you're, quoting these big percentage increases.
Before we get into that ticketing discussion, Mark Geiger, former head of music at William Morris Endeavor, predicted at just after the end of COVID that we would be embarking on the Roaring Twenties again, 100 years after the Roaring Twenties of the last century. And with the claustrophobia of COVID, people were going to come out, and it was just going to be booming. And do you think he was right in that prediction? Are we seeing that?
So, Bill, I think the misleading piece, and I'm curious if Jared on the talent side would agree with this. The misleading piece of that report is there's a disparity between the haves and the have-nots, and the haves are a small portion. And I think if you looked at that global touring number and said, how much of that is going to the top 20, 50, 100 artists in the world? And so I think and Mark, who is a great friend to all of us, and someone I have tremendous respect for, and once a year I like to go to see him and get the world according to Geiger. But I think where he may have been off is the spending went up, but it was not across the board. It's the big mega acts, the Taylor Swifts, the Billy Joels, the Rolling Stones, that are benefiting. And the vast majority of clubs and venues and tours are in a di relatively different levels of boats.
Well, let's talk about. Go ahead. Sorry.
I also
You...
think, Bill, there was probably this 2 or 3 year glow on the business because there was such overwhelming demand to get back out there. And I think now we've kind of normalized. And I think artists were being so successful right after COVID that they thought, oh, we can just keep going out every year. And, a lot of it was, I think now we have some oversaturation with too many artists working every year. And, I think you're seeing some push, some resistance where the first year or two after COVID, everything was just, tickets were just flying out.
Well, you also have the issue of people's pocketbooks haven't gone up proportionate to the ticket price. So let's say a family's budget for entertainment, in a year is $500. Once upon a time, they could see 10 shows for $50. Are they now seeing, three shows for $150? So again, the money's going to those premium artists, and they're not doing the other things that maybe they would have done if they'd had more discretionary spending.
So there's this DOJ lawsuit against Live Nation, which is merged with Ticketmaster. It's an antitrust lawsuit. It's in discovery right now. What are you guys thinking about it? It's basically also become a political thing. We can say that we have Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, and Mike Lee, is it from Utah? The Republican, who are really blaming the Live Nation, Ticketmaster, and others for the rise in tickets, and not looking at the artist. Isn't it the artist, though, that controls the ticket price? And how does it work? And can we talk a little bit about the margins and all of that stuff?
Yes, and one thing to go back to, what Danny said just before, there's also the rising costs of touring due to inflation. So a big part of why there may be less discretionary income and why we've had to raise prices from the artist side is because they can't run a profitable tour when stage hands have gone up, trucks have gone up. Production is very expensive, and thus, you have to raise prices accordingly. But to back it up in more general, the price is usually a function of the guarantee that the promoter or venue is giving to the artist. And then you have to, back out from there enough money to cover, the artist's costs and the production and still leave enough profit for the artist. I mean, that's an overgeneralized way of describing it, but that's in its essence how you get to the ticket price. So when Live Nation comes out and says against the DOJ, we're not setting the ticket prices, they are correct. I mean, it's real because it is a function of what the artist is, requiring from them for a guarantee. And I think there's a lot of negligence on the part of the government officials who have come out grandstanding about Live Nation and about Ticketmaster without really knowing how things work.
When I think, Jared, a lot of the anger towards Live Nation really belongs towards the third party secondary market brokers, because they're the ones that are buying up tickets in bulk and then selling them for 10x, and neither you nor your clients nor I are participating in that. And so I think some of the frustration is misguided, and they've started to focus on the ticket price, but that isn't the root of the problem. Is the you know isn't that's economics, that's supply and demand, and like Jared said, that's market forces along with rising costs. The root of the issue, is Live Nation a monopoly? Yes, but not for the reasons that the DOJ and the public think.
Can you expand on that a bit? Like, well, what, why is it? Why do we need to have a monopoly? And there is AEG. Are they not? They're not as large as Live Nation, but is there an argument by Live Nation that they're not a monopoly, or are they admitting that they just say, are you saying that we need that because of the economics? What are you saying?
I'm just
There
saying
are
factually
festivals like
bread.
Glastonbury going on this weekend that is not a Live Nation
Yeah.
festival.
So,
But there are four major festivals in the UK, and three of them are, I believe, Live Nation.
yeah, I think first of all, it's not the festival market specific. It's the entire live events business where I think that Live Nation does have a monopoly. I think Jared, you're probably in a better position to speak to the relative size of AEG to Live Nation because you're on the sell side.
Yeah, and I think as it just relates to what we were talking about with ticketing, I think Live Nation gets a lot of the brunt. Live Nation Ticketmaster gets a lot of the brunt for the high ticket prices. But if they are not capturing it, especially on hot events, the secondary market is. So as Danny says, it's really a function of supply and demand. So unless you can cap the resale costs, which I just saw in Maine, the government's governor signed into law that there's a 10%, and let's see how easy it is to enforce or not is a whole other story. But unless you can enforce something like that, it's really tricky. I mean, how do you prevent somebody from selling the ticket? And trust me, secondary market, I know a lot of brokers. They're backed by hedge funds. They have technology that gets them the bots to capture these tickets. There's major money in the secondary market. So Live Nation, if they're not using dynamic ticketing, they're just them and the artists are just going to get ripped off by somebody who has nothing to do with the show and has no investment in the
You
show.
know, an
So
interesting thing too is that the scalping of tickets actually exposes what the potential value is when you see what people are actually
yeah,
paying. Now,
correct.
that Maine, just to mention that, the Maine legislation that you're talking about, well, it's Governor Janet Mills signed a ticketing reform act that puts a price cap of 10% above face value. It bans speculative ticketing and includes fee disclosure requirements for both primary and secondary ticketers. And the law also enacts refund requirements on the secondary sellers. We'll see how that works for canceled
That's interesting.
events, counterfeit tickets, and untimely delivery and false representations. It also bans the use of bots to circumvent purchasing limits. I thought California was ahead of the curve, but I guess Maine is the new California.
And what's interesting is the only people who have come out against this are the secondary market, the StubHubs, so. I find that very telling, that something that's all these things are really quite obviously good for the market, especially if the artists really want to keep a price at a certain threshold for their fans. And why would anyone have a problem with that?
And in fairness, Live Nation, they're for those restrictions too. Live Nation is also for putting a limit or some sort of constraint on the secondary
Sure.
seller. We get blamed, the promoter gets blamed, the artist gets blamed. And then that refund thing is so interesting because I can't tell you how many times I have customers mad that I won't refund the tickets that they bought through a broker.
Let's talk about, speaking of refunds, Bonnaroo. Okay, so Bonnaroo, and then you can also talk about it, weather, bad weather. We'll talk about bad weather, Bad Bunny. Is it going to be a bad year for a bad season this summer? But let's talk about Bonnaroo. Now, that was canceled, I think, the first time ever. But there was, and they gave first a 75, it's a 4-day festival, and it was canceled after day one. They gave a 75% refund, and then because of the outcry, they gave 100% refund. I mean, I think people did get one day for free, I guess, but is that fair to the festival? What is your thought?
I think Bonnaroo's original position of 75% is in line with industry custom and practice. That's certainly what I would have done as well. The only thing sometimes we would do is say it's 75% cash back. In that specific case, I might say 75% cash back or 100% credit to next year. But
Right.
I don't think I would have given 100% cash back for the
Yeah.
reason you stated.
But so much of it is PR too. I mean, the same thing with this political game with Ticketmaster, Live Nation, is that you can't blame the artist. You know, you have to blame somebody for the rising tickets, and maybe with good reason. I'm not taking a position on that. I mean, there are fees that people don't like, and you know that. But then with the festival too, they're giving 100% because it's better for their overall image in the public, even though it may be unfair
Bill,
to themselves.
there's one thing that you just said that I think is worth pointing out, and Jared, tell me if you agree. The consumer needs to understand that if they get rid of the fees, the ticket prices are just going up by the same amount that they just got rid of. So getting rid of the fees isn't going to make the tickets cheaper. It's the fees are part of the overall P&L. So when I put together a budget for a festival, my share of those fees is part of that budget. If you cap or eliminate the fees, I have no choice but to just raise the ticket price by the same amount. And maybe that's semantics, it's six of one, but tickets are not getting cheaper by getting rid of the fees.
Let's talk about the fees a little bit. I mean, that these are service fees, delivery fees, processing fees, facility charges. It can be 27% or even 30% of the overall ticket costs on some shows. What's up with that?
The budget doesn't work without those fees. And I think it's a marketing. The reality of the marketing is that if I price a ticket at $150 plus 50 fee, $50 in fees, the consumer is more likely to come into the funnel. Maybe they jump at the end, but now I get the email. If I put $200, how many never enter the funnel? It's a market issue, not a pricing issue. At the end of the day, you're paying the same with or without the fees. It's just for
I
the
think
most cost.
what doesn't come up enough, guys, in this, in the fear is the venue's role in this, right? Venues, especially in America mostly, where it's in the UK, you can use multiple ticketing systems, but basically, most venues are exclusively with a ticketer. They're getting an advance money, an advance check for that from a promoter or a ticketing company. And they then tack a big chunk of those fees are being used to make up for the money that they gave to the venue to be their exclusive ticketer. So I find it interesting that the venue side of it never comes up with all this, government backlash about fees is that the venues by having an exclusive and getting paid for that exclusive are in essence kind of forcing the hand of ticketing companies to need to have these big fees to pay that money back.
But the venues are going to make the same argument that, hey, without those advances, I can't do my infrastructure improvements. I can't keep, stay competitive. My cash flow is not enough to operate. So at the end of the day, it's like the economics are the economics, right? If a show costs $1 million to produce and the profit margin needs to be 100,000, so I got to make a gross of 1.1, one way or another, I'm getting there.
Now let's talk a little bit about the history of the split between the venue and the artist and the promoter, et cetera, production. Just the famous story of Peter Grant, who sort of turned the industry on its head. He was the manager for Led Zeppelin, and it used to be that the artist would get maybe 30%, if that. And he changed it around. I mean, he changed it around so that the artist gets 90% of the door, and then the venue gets 10%. And with Led Zeppelin, he could command that when at the height of their career. Talk a little bit about how where we're at now, how that's kind of evolved, what the split of the door is now. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but maybe just drill down a little bit on that.
Jared, you probably have more. I'm happy to
If
comment, but you have
we have
more.
a if we're representing a super superstar and we're getting anything less than 100, we're probably not maximizing their revenue, to be honest.
There are times you get 110%.
Sure, with certain rebates and fees, and again though, those artists are spending a lot of money on production, and it costs a lot to tour, and I would argue that they should be reaping the benefit of that. And I was very happy a few years ago when Springsteen kind of got some backlash for his prices. He kind of put it out there and was like, hey, if it's not going to me, it's going to the secondary market. And I've been putting my, blood, sweat, and tears into this for 50 plus years. But I think, what it goes back to too is I think a lot of the fan, but there's a lot of fan irrationality when it comes to concerts.
Very
Like
true.
Danny and I were talking the other, it's like when the Knicks are in the playoffs, they can charge whatever times, and you're not seeing necessarily the consumer backlash. I think fans feel they have this connection to the artist, which is great, but it's like that doesn't entitle you to a 10th row seat at the price that you feel comfortable paying. It's still a market, and it's still, there's still economic factors involved. And I think when sometimes fanhood creates irrationality, and those no one wants to know about these real life factors.
Yeah,
For
I
sure.
agree 100% with Jared, and not to blame the consumer, but hey, if you're willing to pay the $1,000 to the third party secondary market, what are you saying about our pricing? Right? I mean, this is simple supply and demand, simple economics, and the best way to bring ticket prices down is say I'm not going to pay it.
Listen, the other part of the pricing, and just to be candid here, is there are sometimes where artists and promoters overshoot and they go into bigger venues than they're capable of selling, or they spend so much money on production that they need to charge a certain amount to recoup. And that's where you end up with, tours that aren't doing well. And, basically, you have seat maps online that, the whole thing is available because the pricing is just not reflective of, what the artist's demand is. And, I think that's a mistake on multiple sides, from the artist to the manager to the agent to, the promoter. So that does happen from time to time. And, it's hopefully, I think, as more are, I think there'll be more, as more tours struggle and have that pushback, bands and their teams will be more realistic moving forward about, where they are in the touring ecosystem.
Jared, something you said to me the other day is so true. Like, I'm just thinking about this. Like, imagine if Apple sold X number of iPhones, and that's it. We're gonna sell a million iPhones, and if you don't get one of the original ones on the initial release, you can now buy it on a secondary market. What would those phones sell for? And
Right.
you said the other day, listen, what was Taylor Swift gonna do? She could have played 10 more shows in every market, but she's not gonna tour for 3.5 years.
Right. It's so in a situation like that, which obviously is an aberration where there's basically infinite demand, not everyone's going to be happy, and the prices are going to be high, and there's just it's impossible. I said, it's like, hey, every girl wants a Cartier love bracelet. Not every girl's going to have a Cartier love bracelet. That almost became what a Taylor Swift, concert ticket was like.
When you're talking about a split of a 90, 100, or even 110% of the door, and where and the venues are also getting large minimum guarantees, I don't see how that works. Now, it's not an advance. A minimum guarantee is not an advance. It's a payment.
So,
But how
there's separate concepts. So, take the venue advance out of it. I'll take that off the table for a second. Let's just use simple math and say the venue has 100 seats at $100 each. 100 seats, $100 each. But now I have to do that math. What is that? 100
Yeah, 100 seats at $100
$10,000.
each is
That's
going to be it's going to be 100,000,
10,000 gross or 100,000?
10,000. Yeah.
Let's just say it's $10,000 gross. So if I sell out the venue, I'm bringing in 10,000. Jared's going to price his our artist at around, in that case, 8,000. We're going to fight somewhere between, what do you think, Jared? 7,000,
Sure.
8,500 in that example.
Depends on the strength of the artist, but
Yeah.
sure.
That'll be our fight. And then Jared's going to take, schmuck insurance and go, but it's also, you're so let's say we settle on $8,000. He's going, but Here's the rub. I also, if the door ends up being more than we thought, I want 85% of the door. So if I somehow manage to raise those prices and now I bring in $12,000, Jared Schmuck Insurance says he's getting 85% of that $12,000. And that's how the basic pricing of a live show works. Now, festivals different. Festivals totally different economics, but a headlining show that most people go to, that's the simple math. And so then on a superstar, Jared might say, I don't give a crap. I'm taking 100% of your ticket sales because this artist is so hot. You're
But
guaranteed
in
to
that
show
case,
up.
and a lot of superstar artists do that, they'll say to the promoter, you don't have to put up a minimum
I'll
guarantee.
take the door.
Give me 95% and we get a piece of all your kind of rebates and ticketing and side bets, and that sometimes is the case too. If you kind of know you're going to sell out and you don't need that guarantee, because you're
Some
you, you
promoters,
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, some artists that are ARFA clients will just self-promote and go, I don't even need a promoter. I know I'm going to sell out. Well, I'll just do it myself.
Only very special agents can do that,
Well,
Dan.
I said
Taylor Swift.
ARFA clients. I said only ARFA clients.
Right. So we in terms of like insurance and weather cancellations and things like that, the weather has been a little crazy. I mean,
Guys, I'm going to shut my, the light came on in my thing. I want to.
okay. Yeah. Is that an anomaly, or do you think that is insurance? Can you talk a little bit more about insurance on that, Danny? And, are the insurance issues around weather right now? Because it does seem like, we have extreme weather right now and cancellations of festivals that we weren't seeing before. Bonnaroo was never canceled before.
Yeah. So cancellation insurance is a really interesting topic. First of all, I don't know if people know that a show can buy insurance to ensure its revenue in the event that the weather cancels the show.
And likewise, Danny, not to cut, an artist can also ensure their guarantee and their costs.
All the players in the DWP, we also own a concession company that, when we were concessioning for third parties, we would insure our concession revenue. So, right, every player in the mix can insure what they were going to make. So the interesting thing about it, and this, I'm not making any political statement about global warming or whatever, but in the 15 years that I have been a concert promoter, the cancellation insurance has gone from 0.9% of my budget. So if I want to insure $1 million, I'm going to pay 0.9% of $1 million. To today, it can be anywhere from 4 to 6% of my total budget, depending on the market. And the market meaning the loss history in that market. So every time a market has a loss, the premiums now go up in that market. So Bonnaroo could very likely see an increase in its insurance next year as a result of this year's cancellation. And that has cut into show margins. Maybe you go, oh, 0.9% to 4%, that's not that big. But when your margin's 10 to 15%, that's huge.
And then where it trickles down on our side is now you have the promoters not wanting to spend the money on insurance, and then there's a cancellation. And they're going to have a clause in there that, weather related, we don't have to pay. And now the artist who, some artist losing a show or two is the whole difference in their tour budget going from profitable to not profitable. So if they lose a few weather related shows because, the promoter didn't have insurance to pay the artist, or even the artists themselves couldn't insure themselves because it's too expensive now, then, the tour goes upside down because you lose a couple shows.
Well, you artists have a tougher time than me because you might have a one or two show deductible.
Correct. Deductible, and also depending on the age and previous medical history, I've seen rates as high as 10-15% on artists, and
For the
it's just
illness and for the illness insurance.
It's yes, and it's got it's just crazy. And weather too, it's just through the roof. But I don't have a solution for that, and I don't know that the insurance companies are necessarily going to get any cheaper. I think they're probably seeing this market as probably one they're not going to be very successful in.
So when I talk to the insurance brokers that I have relationships with, they say it's pretty cyclical. And so to Jared's point, right now, let's say there were 15 or 16 insurance companies that were writing cancellation, and now it's down to seven or eight. They said, hey, over time, when others will come back into the space and see it as a potential profit. So it kind of ebbs and flows. But in these low points, because they also say we're only going to write this much total insurance, or we're only going to write, I'm insurance company X, and I'm going to write 500 million in cancellation insurance, and there's $2 billion worth of shows out there. That means 1.5 billion is not getting insurance, and so that becomes a real risk to promoters that you just
The
can't get
flip
insurance.
side, I think also a lot of promoters and artist teams would say there's a track record in our business, and I'm sure this, this applies to insurance companies not paying or basically, trying to weasel out of claims, and it
Oh,
starts to become so difficult that you're just like, you know what? I'm going to just take the risk because even if I buy insurance, the odds of me being paid out are low.
yeah. Oh, it. There's so many nuances to what Jared just said in how you write that policy. What specific weather event did you insure? Rain? Did you insure cancellation because the government, canceled you? Did you call the show, or did the government call the show? Who made the decision? Did the artist refuse to play? And he's right. The insurance company, their position is you're probably financially hurt right now. You got to refund millions of dollars worth of tickets. I'm going to drag this out and see what happens. So, we'll give you 50 cents on the dollar.
So, an funny anecdote about, insurance is during COVID, we insured our artist tours, which basically means we were protecting our commissions. So when, a handful of our bigger tours went down, we were insured. And the key reason we were actually successful in getting paid is because the WHO never came out and called COVID a flu variant. Had they, that would have been considered some, pre-existing, virus that exists,
Right.
that was out there, and for whatever reason, that would have been exempt from, having to the insurers having to pay on it, as opposed to COVID, which was, brand new and not a flu variant, so we were able to successfully make a claim. And I just remember every day I was like, please don't call it a flu variant, please don't call it a flu variant.
Whereas
And
our
we
cancellation, it's a great point, right? We had inclement weather cancellation only. So we couldn't collect on COVID because we only insured inclement weather. Jared must have insured something broader.
yes,
Now there was
but
an incident a few years ago too at the Mandalay Bay with the shooting, that terrible shooting at that event there, and that they said because it wasn't considered quote unquote terrorism, it would not be covered.
you have to buy active
Separate.
shooter,
Yeah.
terrorism, like the And again, you're right. Like the slightest difference, if I bought terrorism and the police call it an active shooter, no, you can't collect.
It's
Wow. Well, we've talked about we talked a great conversation here about bad insurance issues, and we talked about bad weather. Now let's talk about Bad Bunny. Bad Bunny says that the U.S. is not necessary. He's doing a residency, I believe it starts July 11th in Puerto Rico, where he's from, at a venue there. And then he's one of the biggest artists in the world right now, a world tour, but he's excluding the US. And that's a bit of a political statement. Drake and the party next door up in Canada are doing the same thing. I believe that Shakira canceled her LA show. She's not canceling her US tour because, fear of ICE agents coming in and arresting people. I mean, that's a real thing. You also have one artist named Julion Alvarez, a very big Mexican artist who was an article in Billboard about having a sold out 50,000 seat
stadium date, and he couldn't get across the border because they pulled his visa without any notice at all. So you have these issues. Is this something that we're going to be seeing? Well, of course, you can't predict it, but is this a let's talk first about Bad Bunny not touring in the US and others as well. Is the US quote unquote not necessary as a market for a live act? And give me some perspective on that. What is going on?
I'll bet you dollars to donuts that Bad Bunny tours the US next summer.
Okay. And so that means that this would be a great marketing thing for one thing. But it also
Genius.
makes a statement, and he is popular with the progressive and the most people, I would say, that around in LA and New York, big markets, I think would be rooting for him, I think, at this point.
Genius, genius marketing.
I think it's actually quite the opposite. The US is still the most lucrative touring market, and especially in that I think there is a little bit more acceptance of higher ticket prices than there are in Europe. The venues are a little bit more flexible and aggressive in what they will give to get artists in their room, where like in Europe and these old municipalities and soccer stadiums, they'll just be like, tough shit. You don't have to play our venue. And there's just the costs are actually higher. So most artists' profitability, let's just take US and Europe, are going to be a lot higher in the US than they will be in Europe.
Well, I say Viva Bad Bunny, though, for making a statement that brings attention to this issue. But I mean, next year, if he plays the US, wow, look out. People who are couldn't get to see him this year, it's going to be even
Yeah.
bigger, isn't it?
Remember, once upon a time, Pearl Jam didn't sell tickets through Ticketmaster. Guess who's ticket ma you
Sure.
know guess who their promoter is today? Live Nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
To circle back, Bill, because I don't think we ever directly answered about ticket. I mean, Live Nation and being a monopoly. I think a lot of the promoters lobbying the DOJ to break up Ticketmaster and Live Nation simply want to be able to compete and pay less to the artists. And I think Live Nation, who's quite aggressive with, buying talent and is obviously the market leader, I think a lot of these promoters would say, well, if we didn't have them in the way, but being aggressive with talent, the price is going to go down, and now we're a real threat. And I think that what that doesn't take into consideration is one, again, as we discussed, the rising cost for artists. So there's a certain amount of money where it may not be worth it for artists to go on the road if you can't get to that certain guarantee. It's very tough to go backwards. You're not going to say, well, we made 500 a night, but now you're 60 years old. Go leave your wife and
Yeah.
family for 6 months and be on the road, but we're going to do it for 100 less. So I think there are these nuances that are kind of looked past. And I think also the Live Nations and the AEGs of the world, they have the expertise from the production, promotion, marketing, and they know how to put on these stadium shows. And they ultimately, this is a $1 billion business. You need a lot of money to be able to put on shows of this scale. So, we're not going to just as an agency trust all of a sudden, oh yeah, we're going to do this stadium show and bring one of our artists with some tertiary promoter who doesn't have the experience and financial wherewithal to, su support offers and put shows in these places. It's like, yes, there is certain monopolistic elements to these businesses, but they also are the best at it. So, to change that, unless you're saying, oh, your staff has to go elsewhere, I don't really know that this is the answer, because you don't want a stadium someone promoting and producing a stadium show who doesn't have experience doing so. It's not good for the fan, it's not good for the artist, it's not good for anybody.
Right.
I think the issue, I don't think the issue to Jared's point is look, does Live Nation drive up the price? Yes, but that's a free market. And so I don't begrudge them driving up the price. The issue that I have as a promoter is that they can buy artists exclusively. And because they own the venues, because they own the sponsorship, because they own the ticketing, they're able to say, "Hey, Jared, I'm going to pay you X dollars for, a 50-city tour exclusively." And now I can't get the artist without Live Nation's permission. And the analogy that Danny Wimmer came up with that I thought was so brilliant is, imagine you're Burger King and McDonald's owns all the beef cows in the US. And now you have to go to McDonald's to get your beef.
I love that analogy. I do say that probably that I don't like the analogy, however, between a cow and an artist. There are some artists, by the way, who are on Ozempic. So I do want you to know that. But we can talk a bit about also how tour. I want to talk about two things if we have time. One is about smaller venues, and the other thing is just about how whether the tour is to promote the album or the album is to promote the tour. It used to be like when the Beatles started out, they had such a lousy deal that, and other artists in the 50s, it was told, "Oh, you're not going to make any record royalties. That's just to promote the tour." And then the Beatles didn't have they renegotiated, didn't have to tour because they made so much money on recording. Steely Dan never toured. Now they are, and now it's and the thought was, well, we're making enough on record royalties so we don't need to tour. But now we're back to touring. That the records are kind of promoting the tour. Is that where we have we gone for full circle, do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
A
It
hundred percent. Yeah.
I would say it really varies by artist. If you have a pop top 40 artists, that may be more of, still promoting the record, but then you have artists who are still stuck in that cycle of having an album, whether it be a Pearl Jam, touring off an album where it really doesn't matter. No matter what they do, they're going to sell out. And that's just for their own artistic ambition that they're touring off the record. But a lot of artists now, it's really, Dave Matthews tours year in, year out. It's yeah, he could put out a record, but that's not going to really change, his success on the road, because the
Yeah.
audience is coming year is coming no matter what.
But from a promoter standpoint, and I have no data to back this up, but our perception is that artist marketing a new album is helps us in the marketing of the show. So when Jared comes and says his artist is on the tail end of a tour and they've toured the country three times already on a current record, we either don't want the artist or we want to pay less. When he comes in and says, "Hey, this artist has got a record coming out and you're going to be their first or second show on the new record," he gets a premium because
And
we think it's going to help.
look, I think I'm jaded on this subject, since we had an artist who played Madison Square Garden, 104, times without having a new record since 1993. So I think a lot of times we think creatively of how to package and tour and do things that are kind of eventize things, so you're not ha so overly reliant on the record.
Well, let's just talk closing out here on smaller venues, say 1,200 capacity clubs and venues and that business. And of course, COVID was such a killer for that. Though many of those businesses closed, went bankrupt. But fans really want to see acts in clubs. And you have that. And sort of. Where is that going? There was the government bailout, the shuttered venue operators fund or grant that helped them somewhat. But what is it like in this environment now when you have this smaller venue and you're trying to make that model work? Any
What are
thoughts
you
on
seeing,
that?
Jared? Yeah, what are you seeing, Jared, on the club side of things?
Yeah, it's definitely tougher, and obviously we need it as a vehicle for artists to grow and get bigger and develop. One thing that came up, Danny, when we were talking the other day, is I think an underrated aspect of where the clubs are struggling financially is I don't think drinking culture is as
Yeah.
prevalent with the younger, adults and of this generation than it was previously. And I think whereas these clubs are so reliant on the bar, And now with, certain states having legalized marijuana and gummies and this and that, people are getting high or whatever in different ways. And I think that's actually, oddly enough, really hurting, the club business economically.
It hurts, by the way, Jared. That's a great point, and that's true across the board. Even at a mega festival, if I'm earning $50 a head on food and beverage, is a very different outcome than if I'm earning $30 a head, and that's still different than if I'm earning $15, one five a head. And that age, if you look at shows that skew young, those per heads are in fact lower, and not just by a couple bucks. It could be the difference of $50 a head at a rock show and $25 a head at an EDM show for the reasons Jared's saying. And that dramatically impacts the bottom line.
Well, anything else that you guys would like to touch on? Great conversation.
On the club side, I'll just add, that from my perspective, and I've done due diligence on, I've looked at buying clubs for 15 years and never bought one. That anything less than that 1200 cap, everything's got to go right for you to make. And when I say 1200 cap, I mean 1200 capacity per show. Everything has to go right for a year for you to make any money. And so you book a couple wrong shows, you don't get some corporate events, your calendar's not full, you're losing money. And even on those shows that are the 1200 to 5000, it's a little better, but it's not a ton better. And the cost now to build these clubs has gone crazy, and that's changed the ROI. So I think the club business is in a tough spot. And I think that, again, going back to my theory that the consumer has limited entertainment dollar, they're going to spend it going to Jared's stadium show before they spend it going to a club. And that's my opinion, and that's the data, that is data that I have seen. Well,
One takeaway for me would be, a lot of people obviously, the media is going to focus on negative and criticisms, but overall, touring is in a very healthy place, and I think it will continue to be healthy. And I do think, although social media can sometimes be loud and critique ticket prices and this and that, most consumers are going to these events and having a great time, which is why they're going back and why touring is generally healthy and having these great communal experiences. So I think sometimes we tend to nitpick, but ultimately, the concert experience is alive and well.
and I think going back to the Goldman Sachs report that we talked about earlier, I mean, that would be their position as well. And I think they're backing it up with data, particularly with the A-list artists. But hopefully overall, people do love to listen to music, always have, and I hope they always will.
You know what's
Well,
misleading? I just say one last thing because this is a pet peeve of mine. Financial people read that report and think that they should then pour money into the live event space, and they get burned bad. And to Jared's earlier point, if you're investing in people that don't know what they're doing, you're going to lose a lot of money because it is a haves and haves not world. And I've seen that over and over and over. And the SVOG has perpetuated that problem because it gave a lot of money to a lot of people, some of whom are very irresponsible, and kept them in business longer than they probably needed to be or should have been. And that also helps with the inflation because they'll pay exorbitant prices sometimes because they don't know any better.
and to many people say that the music industry is an easy place to make a small fortune out of a large one. So it
Yes.
is one
Yes.
that needs to
Yeah.
be
Well,
handled by people who know what they're doing, including investors who know what they're doing. So
I
for sure.
think that's why it's a lot easier for investors to pour money, and why you see so many investors, buying catalogs and publishing, and it's a lot easier to just have an accountant watching the royalties. Obviously, a lot of these people have administrators actually doing the syncs and doing, but you could have all the money in the world. If you don't know, have the know-how how to put on shows, you can't be in this space. So yes, of course you need the money, but you really also need the expertise. You can't just buy your way into knowing how to do this.
Now, I don't think anyone has better expertise than you two. Excellent advice. And anyone out there, don't try this at home. Get expert advice if you're venturing into the live music space in any regard. I want to just thank you both and hope to have you on again. Thanks again. It's been great.
Thanks. Appreciate the
Our
time.
pleasure, Bill. Thanks.